Today's episode of Brave Journeys is brought to you by Tidy, professional organisers helping bring calm to your everyday. I'm Tammy Faraday and you're listening to Brave Journeys, the podcast about amazing people who've navigated life's invariable challenges with courage, authenticity, grit and grace. In 2006, Cara Llewellyn was living a dream life in her adopted home of New York, having been recruited by Booker Prize-winning author Salman Rushdie, yes, Salman Rushdie, to run the Penn World Voices Festival he'd established for the human rights organisation Penn America. Then one ordinary day, running in Central Park, she lost all sensation in her legs. 2 days later, Cara was diagnosed with MS. But Cara wasn't a stranger to life's blows. Her father, Richard, contracted polio at the age of 20 and spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair. Dignified and ever resourceful, Caro's dad was determined to make every day count, not least by seducing his nurse, that's Caro's mum, while still confined to an iron lung and then marrying her. But when Cara was herself blindsided by illness, cast adrift from everything she depended on, she was furious, toxic and humiliated. Because surprise, surprise, grace isn't hereditary. It's a choice.
We have these passions, but we forget the day-to-day beauty of life is seeing the sun. Just sounds so trite. I can't even believe I'm saying it. But it is actually those moments of, you know, me being on my three-wheel bicycle riding through the park and just thinking, this is good.
Only by reflecting on her father's extraordinary example was Cara able to choose courage and find a way forward, rebuilding her life shard by shard. And if you've got any doubt as to the calibre of this remarkable human being you're about to listen to, in 2020, Cara was appointed CEO of the Wheeler Centre, and her incredible memoir, Diving Into Glass, was shortlisted for the Stella Prize. This is Cara's story. You know, I always know in advance if a chat is going to be like talking to an old friend, and I knew it immediately when I reached out to you for two reasons. The first was that instead of emailing me back, you called me instantly with the most gorgeous message. So that was tick number one. And number two, you chose to include at the beginning of your incredible memoir, Diving Into Glass, a quote from none other than John Wayne, who said, "Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway." So, my dear friendy, are you ready to saddle up with me?
I certainly am ready to jump on the horse with you and we can giddy off into the sunset.
Sounds beautiful. Okay, so let's go back. At the tender age of 20, your dad, who wasn't yet your dad, he contracts polio on the high seas and he's confined to an iron lung and the medical fraternity don't give him much hope. But your dad is this strong, charismatic, fiercely bright, playful guy whose life's attitude was never why me, but rather why not me. And yet I kept thinking, for such a trailblazer who was destined for a life of adventure, to be stilled in the prime of his life might have justified a why me response, no?
Tammy, you're right. I think most people would say why me. I think hands down most people would. And I don't know exactly what it was about his personality that said, you know, when he woke up and he was told that he would never walk again and he probably wouldn't live, he said, well, this is going to be interesting. When he used to tell me that, I used to say, I just don't believe you, Dad. That's just you just trying to, you know, sugarcoat things and make me feel better as a kid. But I actually believe it was really true, because I don't think you can come out of something like that in the way that he did unless you absolutely believe that. You know, and I'm not sure whether that happened straight away, Tammy, that, you know, he woke up and then he was just miraculously, or there was some time, but he had a whole year in that iron lung to think about what his response was going to be, because you have choices. Your response can be, why me? And you can be angry and you can be feel that you've been ripped off in life and feel resentful and have a chip on your shoulder and walk around. Or you can say, I'm going to make the very best of this and I'm going to try to live as well and as fully as I possibly can. and I'm going to be cheerful about it, because nobody, we all know, nobody wants whiny people who are complaining and who are angry. It's hard to be around those people. So those were probably the choices he had, and I think he probably analyzed it pretty methodically like that, in a way to say, I've got two choices here. I can either be a miserable bastard, or I can get on with my life and try and make the best of it.
So when he was diagnosed with polio, and when the medical team were kind of aware of his situation, he had paralysis in 95% of his body. He spent most of the days kind of looking at walls, white walls, in that first year where he was hospitalised. Can you please share with me the extraordinary start to your mum and dad's love affair?
He was in an iron lung, and an iron lung is like, it's a little bit like a rocket ship with a space for a head to stick out. So that was on a little wooden block at the time with a bit of a pillow, but that was all you could see of him. So this contraption around him, like a spaceship, and his head. And in waltzed my mother, who was a nurse, a trainee nurse at the time. You know, I think the nurses came around, this is how I imagine it anyway, that the nurses came around in a group, and they were told about the patients, and they were told, given their orders and their instructions about who they'd be looking after. He spotted her and he thought, she looks like a woman who I could have some fun with. And they talked, you know, they talked a lot, and she became a really wonderful advocate for him and made him feel like he wasn't, you know, a 20-year-old in an iron lung. She made him feel like he was adorable, and they had a lot of fun together. So it was a very nice, you know, and amazing for her, amazing that a woman at that time could see a life with a man like that and want to go on that adventure with him.
I don't want to be too graphic, but the miracle of your father's illness was that because your mother was his nurse, she had occasion to notice early on that polio hadn't destroyed all his function. So she was able to relate to him as a virile, young, robust man, and the disability became very much secondary. Is that true?
I think it was always amazing to walk into a room with my father, and particularly when we were older and there was a whole gaggle of us. So, you know, and you could see it looking, and when he would say, here's my children and here are my grandchildren, and you could actually see the little cogs going around in people's heads because, you know, he's in a chair, he's profoundly disabled, and so many people used to ask me, well, how did that happen? How did your father, is he really your father? Because it was very hard to believe that that one thing in his anatomy was still perfectly able to do what it was meant to do, let's say that, and when everything else had been pretty much unable to do, you know, had been affected very badly by polio. So he was very lucky, and I think he knew that, and I think he knew that that was a blessing.
So your parents get married, and they have this really palpable love affair, and your grandmother, your maternal grandmother, was not happy about their union at all. I think she said something along the lines of, to your mother that is, I would prefer you were marrying a dog, which was very startling to read. But your mother also was a trailblazer. They get married, they have your brother, and then you're born. And when they have your brother, they seem to be madly in love. By the time you come along, which is no reflection on you at all, but your parents' marriage had sort of dramatically declined and had become a very unhappy and a very toxic one at this stage. Is it right to say, I might be jumping ahead here, but is it right to say that your mother at this point would actually have rather left the family, but in the circumstances and because of your father's dependency, she used other escapes, and with your dad completely at her mercy? Because what we should also clarify, in the 50s, had your dad not gotten married, not in any way to mitigate your parents' relationship, but had your father not gotten married, his life would have been one in an institution. There were no other options.
No, the options back then were you either stayed with you could go to a family if a family was able to look after you. But you've got to remember there was no apparatus. There were no lifting machines. It was all very hands-on and manual. So, you know, you could stay with a family if that were possible, or you would go to a place. And in the time, it was called the Home for Incurables. And my father knew that those were his two options. Now, I'm not saying that he chose my mother and he fell in love with my mother in a manipulative way because he saw that that was his way out. They were very deeply, deeply in love, but it was very unusual to find a woman who'd be willing to take all of that on like she did. So amazing. And I think that by the time that their marriage had gone sour, it was very hard for my mother. She couldn't just leave. She knew that if she left, you know, normally you can pack up and you can go and people are heartbroken, but they're not going to be put into an institution. And that was something that she didn't want on her conscience. And I'm internally, you know, I think that that was an amazing sacrifice that she made for him and for us. Not an easy one to make, but of course it meant that it was a very unhappy home. She was trapped. That's never a good place for anybody to be.
And because your dad was really at her mercy, particularly when the relationship had deteriorated so profoundly, he turned a blind eye to her infidelities and to her demons.
I don't think either of them had very much choice. I don't think that it meant that my mother wasn't a, you know, a good person. She was a young woman and she had strapped herself to this very dependent person, and she also had two small dependent children, and it was a lot. And if you think about, you know, everything from waking up in the morning, you know, two screaming children and a man who can't do anything to help, that's a huge burden. So, you know, I think it's not a surprise that my mother, you know, felt the need to find other ways and means of escape. And, you know, so it's no judgment to say any of this about her, but I think that she was extraordinary. And my father was very lucky because in waltzed another woman into our lives, and she became, you know, a very big part of our life, and he was able to, they were both able to have an escape. So my father had a carer who is now my stepmom, and, you know, he was a very charming man. He did it twice.
It's such a beautiful story because I've seen photos of your father. He sort of arrested your attention. He was very captivating and he seemed very physically robust. It's kind of a strange dichotomy considering he was so limited in terms of his physical ability once the polio took hold. But looking physically robust and strong meant something to him. So the fact that two gorgeous women fell in love with him at different points is not really very surprising at all. But the way that that relationship came about, that secondary relationship, is very interesting because your mother wanted to go and she hired a very lovely carer to look after you, your brother, and your father. And I think, if I'm correct, Caro, your mother said to Becky, who's now your stepmother, "You're my way out." It was like her guilt-free pass to be able to kind of leave the family and leave the strain. And then, beautifully, Becky and your father fall madly in love. And what I wanted to come to, because this is pretty unusual, you know, you can't make this stuff up really, but your mum leaves for months, but then she returns and she comes back to the family home. So it's you, your brother, your mother is living in the back of the house, and your father's living with his lover, and she comes and resides with you guys. So it's all happy families. Well, it was for a point. And then there's one night where all of you are about to have a family meal together. And I think what was so novel about that evening, even to start with, was that you were all sitting at the table together. Because ordinarily, is it true that you and your brother would eat on the floor and watch television for most meals?
Yeah, I think like a lot of kids in that era, it wasn't, you know, we were just, we were TV kids. And, you know, my parents were, they were both working, they had the art gallery, and there was a lot of, you know, manoeuvring with Dad, obviously. So, yeah, we were fairly independent, and I think a lot of the time on the floor watching Bewitched or whatever it was.
You speak of something feeling different. And I think when you come from a home where there has been discord, or whether there's been trauma, or whether there's been worry or hypervigilance, you kind of know what's going to happen before it ever happens. So you're feeling something is off, something's awry. And Becky and your father have furtive glances with one another. And then Becky puts her hand on your father's tray, and your dad maneuvers his hand to touch hers. And something in that moment made your mother snap. What happened that night, Caro?
This is seared in my memory in this way. But I think if you asked every other member of my family what happened that night, they would probably have slightly different or indeed very different perspectives. So from my point of view, what happened that night is, yes, I think my father and my stepmother, well, she wasn't my stepmother then, Becky, made the mistake of sitting at the end of the table together like a young couple in love, and which they were. And my mother thought that it was going to be okay, and she thought that she would do this in the best possible way that she could, and we would be civilized and we would all manage our emotions and we could do this. And there was something that happened in that moment that you described between my father and his new love, Becky, that just must have just been too much for my mother to cope with. And she flew into a rage, cleared the table, and it was all quite dramatic and, you know, violent and very upsetting and I'm sure very distressing. It was distressing for everybody, not just me and my brother. It was like we were in a pressure cooker. There was all of this stuff going on, and it's very easy to say, you know, oh, well, you didn't love him, you wanted out of this marriage, and here was your perfect escape. And but then I think when you see it, you know, I think when you see it and you see the intimacy and you think, what's going on? And then I think, you know, we all have really complex emotions. And my mother said to me years later, I said, what happened? And she said, everybody loves their jailer. And I think that that's, in a very strange way, probably a very true thing. And I think that that moment of realizing that he had fallen in love and really had been fallen in love, and she saw it in a very clear way, that it made her feel very upset. And, yeah, it wasn't great.
But that's something that I adore about you, because the human condition is about nuance. You know, you can be an amazing daughter and you can be a terrible partner. You can, you know, we all have so many strings to our bow. That's what makes us human, and that's what differentiates us as a species. And you write with such nuance, and you have such incredible compassion. You wrote really poignantly about your mother, which really touched me deeply. Because the truth is, your mum might not have been cut out for a life of being a full-time, lifelong caregiver, but that didn't make her a terrible person. That made her human. And you say, my mother grew up going to dances in beautiful dresses. She read English Vogue, loved glamour and elegance, yet she was willing, at least at one point, the best point, in fact, to hitch herself to the very unglamorous, inelegant daily routine of caring for my father. No matter what happened after that, or how any of us fared when it went sour, her actions at the time were heroic. There's so much empathy and magnanimity and nuance in that. And that's a real tribute to your mum. And I love that, because she was clearly a very empathic person. She went into the nursing profession. You don't do that unless you've got an incredibly big heart. But at the same time, she was very volatile and very unpredictable, and it seemed to escalate as time went past. I want to ask you, what does growing up with a mother like that do to your sense of safety and well-being and security?
I think it was from both of them that I have a sense of hypervigilance, I guess. And I grew up with two very needy parents, you know, in a way, and my mother emotionally needy and my father physically needy. So I say it's actually been very good for my career, because I see things before they happen. I'm aware of things. I plan things. I notice the nuances, and I can usually, not always, but most times, get ahead of problems before they happen, because I was always looking out whether or not we could get into a restaurant. If we went somewhere with my dad and there were steps, so my brother and I were always running off ahead, being told to go and see, you know, can we get in? So we were always running in. The other great thing that I learned as a child is to find solutions. So 99% of the times back then, there were no ramps. It was stairs everywhere. And so we were never able to get in. So my father would say, well, go and find another entrance. Go round. So we would go around the back. We would go in through the kitchens. And So we were great problem solvers because he taught us to be that. He didn't want to just be thwarted and said, well, we're just going to go home. Sometimes, obviously, we had to. He was a solutions man, and he would always be trying to find ways that he could be included in the rest of society and contribute. And he did that with his work and his later campaigning for accessibility and changing the way that people thought about people with a disability.
Your parents split, as in physically split. So Becky and your dad move out. You stay with your mum. Your brother seems to shuttle between both houses. You don't really see your father for 4 years. So I would imagine, maybe I'm projecting, but there's senses of abandonment kind of all round, because your mother kind of wasn't in a maternal phase of her life at this juncture. She'd kind of had it by then, it seems. She was worn down. And as I said, your dad was in another premises and you really didn't see him for many years after that. You say something that I mentioned to you last week when we spoke on the phone before our chat today was quite triggering for me. But you say, a child's loyalty to a parent is a given. It's the sacred rule of the core of being a kid. But a parent's loyalty, it turns out, is not a given. And that sat with me for days. And I wanted to ask you, how much does loyalty mean to you now as an adult? How important is that for you now in light of the childhood you came from?
Wow, what a great question. I've never thought about this, Tammy. I'm going to really have to think about it. So I think loyalty is very important to me. I can turn on a dime if you betray me, that's it. There's no real stepping back from that. I give people quite a few chances, but if it goes too far, that's it. I hadn't thought about it in that way, but I think that that's probably true. That's hard.
It's really hard, but, you know, I've had time to pontificate. You haven't. I've just thrown this at you, which is not very fair. But for me, loyalty is number one. It's number one, number two, number three, number 10. I think when you come from a childhood where the people that are supposed to look after you and nurture you somehow fall short, you might stick your head in the lion's den to continue allowing them to not treat you as well as they should, but you create this force field around you where you won't allow anyone else to do that. It's like, if I had to cop this as a kid, I'm not going to let anybody else do this. And I was very wounded by that in my 20s. And I probably need to apologize to a lot of people for whom the force field came up very quickly and very strongly. My best friend tells me, often we've talked about this, I have literally no recollection of it, but I met her in my late teens and I was a very wounded young woman at that point in my life. And she tells me this story that she offered to help me in some way. She doesn't even remember what it was about, but she just offered generously, wholeheartedly, selflessly, gratuitously to help me with something. And my response, which I'm horrified by and don't recall, was, "What do you want?" Because my brain couldn't compute that somebody would want to do something for me and have nothing in return. I really couldn't get my head around that for many years. And like you, I'll give till the end and I will be the most loyal friend you've ever had. I will stand up and put my head above the precipice no matter what it costs me. But I didn't have any room early on if someone really hurt me or betrayed me. And I probably sabotaged them to test them all the time anyway, because I was waiting for that shoe to drop. But I had no capacity to allow them to have too many chances, because I was always hypervigilant and terrified that someone was going to continue to hurt me or to let me down or to not show up or just not to be there. And a lot of people say that as adults. They just reflect back and they're like, too many people hurt me. I'm not going to allow this to happen again. So it's interesting because you became quite philosophical about your parents' various abandonments, but you went inside yourself and you say that you became sort of silent and steely and resolute so nothing could hurt you and so that no one could ever get close enough to injure you like perhaps your parents had. And some people have mistaken that as a coldness in you, but I can tell you without any formal qualification whatsoever, that's not coldness, beautiful lady. That's self-preservation.
Yeah.
So in your early 20s, you fall madly in love with a Polish 6'4", hard-drinking musician. And you have this beautiful love affair with him, and your son, Jack, is born. And a year after that, your relationship deteriorates and you find yourself at 24 as a single mum. What was that time like?
Well, I had this beautiful angel with me, so it was fine. I was very, I think I've got my father's practicality. And so for me, it was, I just got on with it. I just thought, all right, well, this is how it is now. And it's me and Jack, and we're just going to get on with it. And I got a job as a secretary, and I was answering phones, and I just thought that I had to make something of my life in a way that I didn't. And it was actually a very, in some ways, it was really the making. I think that it was the making of me. You know, I realized that I didn't have any fallback. And if I wanted to make this kid's life a good one, and I didn't want to be, I felt very strongly that I didn't want to be the cliche. Everybody had already been saying to me, are you crazy? You're 23 years old and you're having a baby with him, you know, and the 6'4" hard drinking Polish musician. And then I didn't want them to say, well, see, we told you so. And now the options for your child are going to be limited because your options are limited, and you're going to be the cliche of what it is to be a young single mum who's uneducated and all of those things. And I thought, I will not come into that. I will not let that cliche happen to him. That not wasn't about me. It was about, I wanted to make sure that he had a really good, I was determined not to make the same mistakes that I had had and be that, you know, that generational thing that happens. And of course I've made a million mistakes with my beautiful Jack, but not those mistakes, I think. And so it really, you know, it got me going in life. And, you know, I wrote my first book shortly after, and it just motivated me. And I thought, I want this kid to have a really fantastic life, even though he didn't have a father, to still have a very strong sense of security with me. And I wanted him to have opportunity and go to a nice school and do all of those things. So, yeah, I wanted him to have opportunity.
Fast forward some years, and you speak of having some epiphanies when you lost your dad. The first being that your father's year in the iron lung was like a monk's meditation. He thought his way out of rage so that people around him would never feel it. The second thing was that his mind got him out of his chair every single day. The third thing was, with your dad now passed, Jack, your son, would soon be old enough for you to start a new chapter beyond Australia, which is something that you had a longing to do. And you write in this, again, just glorious passage, you say, I was born into restlessness. I learned from my father to keep my eyes set to the horizon, to plot a scheme for what was next. I didn't understand the idea of contentment. I had to strive for more, push myself harder. Goals weren't met simply for their own sake. I turned my back on my successes like they were cast off lovers and went looking for the next like a true addict. Thank you for putting into words what I felt my entire life.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah.
I just read that and I'm like, I've had this restlessness all my life. I don't know if I was chasing a ghost or I was running away from one, but it was like every few years I had to reinvent. Every few years I wanted to metamorphose. I wanted to become somebody else. I wanted to try a new career, a new iteration of myself. So I felt you in that moment. But I want to ask you, what prompted you to pick up in your early 40s and move to New York? It's not easy to reinvent past a certain point. It's certainly not easy for a woman to do that. What drove you to do that? What was the compulsion?
You know, I was running Sydney Writers Festival and it was very successful. I felt professionally I had got to the point that I could get to here. I didn't really know what else I could do. And also I had fallen in love. I fell in love with an American, and, you know, I didn't tell anybody this at the time. This was my little secret. And that was also motivating me. So I felt I was very pulled by that relationship and thought that if I could be closer and that might work. So I had that drive me as well. Not that I, as I say, I didn't tell anybody that. This was a married man, and I felt that wasn't something I really wanted to admit. I was out of a marriage myself just. So it was a complicated time, but that was a very driving force for me as well as professionally. You know, New York is the epicenter of publishing, and to work in that. And I loved New York. I fell in love with New York. I went there when I was 30 with my best friend, Sophie. And I remember thinking, we were walking down the street, and I remember thinking, I have to live here. I have to make this my place. I just loved it. I just I think New York divides people. You either fall completely madly in love with it, or you don't like it at all, or you just like, yeah, I'll come here and visit every now and again, but it's not really for me, it's too hard. But it's in my, there's something about that city that is in my lifeblood, and I knew that. So there were three or four things going on all at once when I decided to move.
Can I ask you, with a lot of love, and I say this, I hope, with all the sensitivity I can muster, but I'm just so curious about you and your choices and what makes you you. How did you reconcile leaving Jack in Australia, which I know was agonising for you, when you had so viscerally and acutely felt various abandonments growing up?
That's a really good question, and it was a very hard decision. I initially thought that I would, you know, finish up my job at the Writers Festival, I would hand over to a new director, I would look for a new position, and all that would align with Jack finishing his HSC exams. I got the job in New York, and they insisted that I come at the end of September. And I said that there was no need for me to come in September. I could do it remotely, and I needed to stay for my son to get him through his exams. And they said, you either come now or you don't get the job. And I talked to Jack about it at length. You know, he was 16. And he said, Mum, you have to go. This is your dream. You have to go. And Becky came and looked after Jack. And the idea was that Jack would come after his exams. So he would just get on the plane. But, of course, after his exams, he said to me, oh, Mum, I'm in love. I love this girl. I don't want to go. So it didn't quite go to plan. So the original idea was that he would come with me, you know, maybe not straight away, but eventually. And that didn't pan out. But it was the day that I packed my bags and I left, and I left him standing on the sidewalk, and he'd broken his arm and he had his arm in a sling. And I thought, what on earth am I doing? What kind of a parent? And exactly all of those things that you just said, Tammy, you have been abandoned. You know what this feels like, and you're doing exactly the same thing to your son. I had to live with that.
And you know what? There was no judgment in what I said, but and you were a mother since you were 24. You paid your dues. You did so. You gave everything, and you gave your whole life to this little boy who's not a little boy anymore. But for restless types like us, and this is something that I think about quite often, it's hard to straddle this uber maternal drive and the simultaneous wish to have an identity and to self-actualize and not to park our educations and our abilities and our dreams at the altar of motherhood. When has that internal conflict been the most deafening or the most cacophonous for you? Was there ever a point earlier on where you just thought, I just want to do something for me, or I want to be able to experience something that isn't necessarily framed by my motherhood?
No, I didn't feel like that, because I felt that everything that I was, you know, I was building an amazing career. I loved my job. I absolutely loved my job, and I still do. And so that just felt like it was a win-win situation. It was, you know, we had, so motherhood never stopped me doing anything, but it also, it motivated me to do things. And Jack was a wonderful, you know, he was an amazing kid who was independent and willing to go on crazy adventures, and we, you know, and live a precarious life in some ways. I didn't really feel like that, because I felt like I was doing what I wanted to do, because I was very happy professionally. You know, I was writing books and I was running this festival, and I was, you know, that was really living the dream. I never dreamed that that could be my life. And so here I was, and that job was extraordinary. I had so many opportunities and was very lucky. So, I didn't really feel like that, Tammy.
Can we go back to the moment that changed your life on a Sunday in 2009? So this is just after your 44th birthday, I believe, and you go for a run in Central Park. What happened that stopped your ordinary?
So I was in, so by now I'd been living in New York for a couple of years, and I was running the Penn World Voices Festival. I was working with Salman Rushdie. I was working with the world's top international writers in another kind of a dream of what my life was. And that was extraordinary. And I was running, and I had known that something was wrong. I had these strange things going on. I had a funny numbness in my legs, and my foot was not picking up quite properly, and I was tripping a little bit every now and again, and I knew something wasn't right. I went and saw a doctor. They did some tests, couldn't see anything, and then things kept going wrong, odd things, nothing that you could say, oh my gosh, this is all, it adds up, or this is all something wrong with my leg, because there was something wrong with my hand, there was something wrong with my eyes, there was something wrong with my foot. So, and it, none of it made any sense. And, you know, I had all this strange numbness. Then I went for this run and I thought, oh, you know, my leg's not feeling very great, but I'll just run through it. That'll be okay. That's exactly what I would do. I can't feel my legs. I'm going to go for a run. Great. So I did what I always did. I strapped up my shoes, went out, ran into the park, and had this very strange sensation where it wasn't just the surface of my legs I couldn't feel. I actually couldn't feel them on the ground. So I was running like I was on, the way I can describe it, the best way I can describe it is like I was running on two prosthetic limbs. I couldn't feel my feet. I couldn't feel anything that was happening. And I was very unnerved, but I just thought, oh, this has got to pass. This will just pass if I just keep going. And I was going up the hill. I came down the other side of the hill and I thought, oh, I was very unnerved. And I stopped and I put my hands on my pants. And actually, they are the pants that I'm wearing because I've just been to the gym. Weirdly, I still have these pants. And they were completely wet. And I had lost control of my bladder. And I was mortified and so confused. I had no idea what could possibly have happened. I couldn't feel my wet legs. I just knew that what had happened. And I was just so perplexed and so terrified. I knew something terrible was wrong, but I didn't know what. And I just tramped into the bushes. I thought, I can't have anybody see me. This is just too embarrassing. And so I've walked into the bushes, and up there at that part of the northern end of Central Park, it was a bit wild back then. And I was in the middle of this scrub, and I just thought, I had no idea what could possibly have happened, but I knew my life was never going to be quite the same again.
You really knew it in that moment.
Yeah, I knew something terrible had happened, really terrible. Didn't know what, but yeah, I did.
What did you do next?
I pulled myself together. I wrapped my top around my waist and I walked home and I threw everything in the washer and I filled up the bath and I got into the bath and I put my head underwater and I screamed as loudly as I could. And the next day I rang the doctor and he said to me, what's happened? And I told him and he said, get up here. So I was at the doctor that same day and they were doing tests and they didn't even know what it was. It was a very strange presentation. So it turned out that I had multiple sclerosis. It didn't make sense to them. So it was a very odd situation. And, of course, I was hanging on to every skerrick of possibility that it could not be MS. I'd seen somebody with MS as a child and I remembered it being a not very, you know, back then MS was in most cases not a great prognosis. And she had very advanced MS and she was not good. So that's how I equated it. And that's what I thought when they said, you've got MS, that was what my life would look like. So yeah, it wasn't the happiest of times.
What were your greatest fears, Caro, that MS would rob you of? Because you can't just look at your case in isolation. You know, you had a childhood with a dad with a profound disability. So your diagnosis of MS did exactly what to you?
Well, we started off the conversation about my father saying, you know, why not me? And all I could say was, why me? Like, it just seemed so incredibly unfair. Not because it happened to me, but it happened to me who'd had a father like that. Like, this was all in the one family. Like, that is just not fair. So it was very much why me, and I was very angry. One of the things that Dad had always said to us or said to me when I was a kid, he always said, you go off and live the big adventure. Live the biggest life that you could possibly lead because I'm your fall guy and I've got all the bad karma for our family, so you can go off and just live this, whatever you want to do. And I did exactly that. I took every risk. I did everything that I said yes to, everything and more. And so to be told that I was going to be stopped and that this was going to be my new reality just seemed to me profoundly unfair. I was really angry because I thought, no, that can't be true, because my father told me that this would never happen to me. And I was cranky about that too. I remember the doctor standing at the end of my bed and saying, you know, do you live in a house with stairs? And I almost got out of that bed. I could hardly walk, but I almost got out of that bed and I wanted to punch him, because I just thought, I know what that means. And there is no way that this is my life. I've lived that life already. I've lived it through my father, and now you're telling me it's going to be my life. And I didn't want, you know, you said, what was your greatest fear? And I think for me, it was, I didn't want to have to tell Jack, and I didn't want to have Jack to have the responsibilities or the sense of, not that there was anything wrong with the way I grew up, because it was wonderful, but I didn't want him to have those burdens on him. So it was tough. And of course, the moment it happened, he called. Jack has a strange premonition, as I do with him. So the day that he was getting a tattoo, when I called him and he said, I said, hi, darling. He said, hi, Mum. And I said, what are you doing? He said, what do you mean, what am I doing? And I said, I know you, what are you doing? You know, I'm in New York, he's in Sydney. He's like, what do you mean, what am I doing? I said, I know you're doing something wrong. What is it? And he said, oh, all right, I'm getting a tattoo anyway. And so I sat down on the bed after all of this had happened, and the phone rang. And I thought, it's going to be Jack. So I pulled myself together. Hi, darling, how are you? And he said, what's on? What's wrong? And I said, nothing's wrong. Everything's fine. He said, I know something is wrong. Tell me what is wrong. So, Wow. Yeah.
I have that mental telepathy with my mother as well. I know, I always know if something's wrong before the phone call's even made. I just know it. I always have. But I think it's indicative of an incredible bond between you and your son. I mean, it was the two of you. That was the incredible love, you know?
Yeah.
So he sensed it. How did you tell him?
I couldn't tell him for a while. Of course, you know, I just said to him, look, I'm in the hospital. Everything's fine. It's going to be fine. They're just doing some tests. It's nothing to worry about. But of course, he was worried. Miraculously, 4 days later, when I got out of hospital, Becky was... had been scheduled to come and stay with me. So I left the hospital when Becky was at home waiting for me and looked after me. And then Becky sent Jack over. So Jack came over. And Jack really was awful. Jack couldn't cope. He was used to seeing me as the invincible, you know, mom who took him camping and could play football with him and do all of those things and was unstoppable. And all of a sudden he could see that I was very vulnerable. And he really... I sent him home. He couldn't cope with it, and I didn't want him to cope with it, and I still don't. You know, I still say to him, whatever happens to me, it's not your responsibility. I can look after myself, and I will, and I didn't want him to have to feel that he had to moderate his life and his dreams and aspirations because he had a mother who he might have to look after. You just got to be practical about it. There's no point being sentimental about it. At a certain point, you just have to say, all right, how are we going to deal with this?
I anguished for you because you were so hard on yourself when you were diagnosed. You couldn't accept your diagnosis in the same way that you believed your father had. And you said that had he not accepted his diagnosis, it would have kind of leached out of him like a toxic fume. People can't feign acceptance. They've either got acceptance of their plight or they actually just don't. And you say that your dad made peace with his mobility limitations. He was okay with that. And what he decided what really mattered was the way that he presented himself, and he worked hard at not letting himself go and not looking disabled, whatever that means, despite the undeniable reality of his chair. And I read that paragraph over and over again. I'll tell you why I did, because I thought perhaps your experience with your illness and the diagnosis and the fear and the loss and the grief was normal. And his fighting spirit and determination to make the best of his circumstances was extraordinary, but it was almost beyond normal. It was uber evolved. So that have made him an exceptional man, but that doesn't make you wrong or less than. And it was again that nuance, because I was thinking about your mother also, and I thought she was able to do extraordinary things. And then there was a point she just couldn't. So you struggling with this diagnosis where, as you said, you felt your father had taken the karmic blow for the family, and yet you still find yourself as a young woman diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and really not knowing what this illness means, because it's very hard to diagnose it and it's very hard to know what the trajectory of it is, because it's very idiosyncratic for everybody, I understand. So I just wanted you to be kinder to yourself, because it just really upset me that you were so hard on yourself about how your dad coped. I don't think that there's anybody that wouldn't be stopped in their wake with a diagnosis like that. You know, at the time of your diagnosis, you say you were enraged and you were very angry and that you wanted to get up close to your physician's detached coolness and his very large table, and you wanted to kind of punch him in the head, and you also wanted to ask him for a loaded gun because he suggested that you needed a psychiatrist and you just said you wanted a gun. Do you still feel like that? Does the despair or feelings of despair bubble up often for you anymore?
No, thankfully. I think that's very generous of you to say that, and I think that I was hard on myself. You know, I felt that I had had such a great example of my father from my father, that why couldn't I accept that for myself? Why couldn't I just get on with it and be, you know, be the poster child for, you know, what it means to get a devastating blow like that? And I just couldn't. I couldn't muster it, and I just couldn't get my head around it. And it took me a few years. And it's funny, the other day, Tammy, I rang a friend and I said, in New York, and she saw me through a lot of my worst. And I said to her, you know, I finally, because I've been feeling like this for quite a few years, but I said, I can look back at that time now and think, what a waste. I wasted so much time worried about what my future would be, and I just should have lived in the moment. I was fine, and I'm still fine, you know, and you deal with the issues that you have, but I was just couldn't get out of my own way of just being angry, and that wasn't, it was so not helpful. And I wasted a lot of time. And I look back at, you know, the way that I was then, which was, you know, really, if you met me, you couldn't tell that I had MS mostly. And yet I just was so worried about what the future was. I couldn't be in the present. I was just always thinking about my life is over, it's done. And it wasn't. And I found that very hard to come to terms with. But it was a waste. And I just think if I could do it again with hindsight, you just have to, it's no different from anybody else's life. You don't know what's going to happen. It's today, you know, and I had a wonderful friendship with the writer, Philip Roth, and he said to me, it's here and it's now, he used to say to me, it's here and it's now. There's no point, who knows, I could walk out and be hit by a bus. I could have a heart attack. I could have a stroke. I could have high cholesterol. I could have any number of things happen to me. Or worse, I could lose somebody who I loved. So you never know what's going to happen. So it's here and it's now. And that's what you have to deal with.
Okay. So for someone who's shared quite transparently of late that I live with anxiety, I want to understand how you really internalize that, because it's one thing to just live a very ordinary, pedestrian, mundane life and catastrophize what might happen. It's another thing to get a pretty big blow of a diagnosis and sort of not think into the future and not think about what losses you might experience along the way. Like, I'm not challenging you on it. I want to learn from you. I want to know how you really get to a place where you can have that peace and genuinely internalize it and genuinely live in the present. Everything you say, Kara, makes perfect rational sense. But for someone who's not that rational, I want to understand how you actually make the leap from that sort of that rational platitude to actually really holistically believing it.
I think some of it is time. I think some of it is time and just thinking it through. And I think that time that my father had in the iron lung was a moment where he could just really think. He had nothing else to do, and he could really think his way out of things. And I think you need that moment to pause and to really get your head around something, understand the complexities and understand, you know, what was really underlying my anger. And it was probably a lot of anger that I had unresolved and untalked about my father's disability in my childhood and all of that. And that was probably more about what it was than it was about this other thing. And so I think it allowed me to have rage about that and rage about and understand that, you know, we were a family who just got on with it. We didn't say, oh, poor us and, you know, poor dad or, you know, but, and like I say, it was a wonderful childhood, but it was a difficult. It was difficult. And I think it was all probably tied up in that time with getting that diagnosis and then trying to look back and think about what were the things that I thought about my childhood and my father's illness and all of those things. And I think it all just got racked up together. You know, that book took me 15 years to write. And I think through that process, it helped me putting things on the page. For me, it was very helpful. I could step back from myself. I could analyze it. I could write something down and think, well, why do you actually feel like that? When you write something on the page, you have to question it. And so I think I did a lot of processing through that, through the book. And also, I think the other thing for me in my anger and everything else was a lot of shame. I felt a lot of shame about my diagnosis. You know, I was meant to be invincible and unstoppable. And I felt like it was a weakness in me that this had somehow, which is a ridiculous thing to say. And you know, and I say it out loud and I think, I hope nobody thinks that I'm saying that about anybody else's illness. It was just what I felt about myself. I felt that I had let myself down and I had let Jack down and I let everybody who cared. I felt disappointed in myself. I felt like I had brought this upon myself in some way. So it was complicated. I do think writing, because if you write something and it doesn't make sense, and you think, well, that's a cop-out. That's just something easy to say. And you actually have to analyse it when you write it.
There was a point, very sad point, where you considered taking your life, but your mind kept coming back to Jack, your beautiful boy, and you didn't. Thank goodness for that. But then as heroes do, which you are to me, you save someone else's life. Can you tell me about the man on the Hampstead High Street that you saved?
There was a man, I was in London and I was going back to the places where I had been a waitress in my teens, and there was a man crawling along the road in the middle of the Hampstead High Street. He was on all fours and he was just crawling in the road and cars were swerving around him and beeping at him, and one of those situations where everybody just starts looking and nobody's doing anything. And so I was sitting with my friend Tanya and I said, she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to go and find out what's going on. So I went over to the man and I said, sir, you have to get up off the, you know, you're going to get hurt. And he said, leave me alone, please leave me alone. And I said, well, I can't leave you alone. You're crawling in the middle of the road. You're going to hurt yourself and someone else is going to be responsible. There's cars going everywhere. It was mayhem. And he said, please just leave me. I want to die. Please leave me. And I said, well, I'm not going to. And I thought, and I said, well, I'm just going to get down here on the ground and crawl along with you. If you're not going to get up. I don't know what possessed me, but anyway, that was my way of doing it. And all I remember thinking is, I've got brand new fishnet stockings on and they're going to get ruined. But anyway, here I go. So I got down on my hands and knees and crawled with him, and it was one of the most, it was devastating. You know, he was just, I don't know what had happened to him. He'd lost his family, obviously, probably a marriage breakup. And he just said, I want to die. Now, eventually the police came. You know, I was calling out to people saying, call the police. Finally, the police came and he was taken off. And I never know what happened to that man. I hope that, like me, he came out of that darkness and he was very happy that he didn't go through with what he'd planned or what he wanted to have happen at that time. But when you're in that moment, you can't really see much else. And I was lucky that I had knew that I would never do that to Jack, but I was pretty desperate. I was in a very dark place.
Salman Rushdie was your boss at one point, and he wrote in his own memoir when he was under the fatwa that I must live until I die, and that seems to be a philosophy that you very much adopted yourself. How do you do your utmost now to live your life well?
So, yes, I thought that when I read that in Salman's book, by the way, he was the best boss ever, and I was very lucky to work with him. He was wonderful. He is wonderful. He writing that really struck me that, you know, I must, you live until you die. Like I was saying earlier, I try to live in the moment. I try to not get overwhelmed and not think about what could happen to me. I have good days and I have bad days. And I'm just determined to keep on doing the things that I want to do and not let myself get in my own way, because that's what we do when you do get into a position like that. You let all your anxiety actually stop you doing the things that you want to do. Now, you know, some days it's hard for me to walk down the road to the Kino cinema, and some days I have to get on my three-wheel bicycle to get down there, but I still get down there. And those small things, life is just made up of very small things. We have these passions, but we forget the day-to-day beauty of life is seeing the sun. Just sounds so trite. I can't even believe I'm saying it. But it is actually those moments of, you know, me being on my three-wheel bicycle, riding through the park and just thinking, this is good. Nothing to worry about. And when I have to worry about it, I'll worry about it. And I've got all those plans made and I'll deal with that when I deal with it. But I'm not going to deal with it before I have to deal with it. You know, deal with it when it happens.
I love that. I really do love that. I really want to ask you this as a woman too, because you are a beautiful woman and you are so gorgeously put together. And an illness like this is one where there is so many cumulative losses along the way, probably amazing things that you gain along the way. But I would imagine also that there are things that get lost. Does MS make you feel invisible or too visible?
It makes me very visible, and it's funny because people stare all the time, and I don't notice it anymore. And my partner's daughter is 18, and when we're walking down the road together, she gets very upset about it. She says, "Why do they have to keep staring?" And she stares back at them or she says something to them. And I say to her, "Sweetheart, there's just no, people are curious, you know, they're curious." But I don't think I'm visible in that way. But I've for a long time thought that I wasn't visible in a way that was attractive to a man. I thought that there would be no man that would ever want to be with somebody who walked like me or, you know, looked like me or would have that diagnosis. You know, that was a self-limiting thing. You know, if you think that nobody's going to be interested, well, you put up a whole lot of barriers. And you talked about force fields coming up. You know, I've got plates of steel around me sometimes. And so that was a confronting thing to work out how to be a sexual woman in the world and know that I still had desires and that I didn't believe it would be possible that I could be desirable to somebody, but that was my own bullshit, if I can say that word.
Can say any word. And you know, it's such bullshit to me because I'm looking at you, I'm thinking you're so gorgeous. It is this concept of self-limiting, because we are our own worst critic. Mm. And so I only see magic in you, wondering whether or not someone would find you desirable. And I just find that so strange, but totally understand it at the same time.
And I've been very lucky that I've met a wonderful, when we first started dating and I was trying to, you know, I just thought there's no way that somebody's going to want to, you know, hitch there. And he says, you know, I don't even see MS. I just see you. And that's all he cares about. And so again, it's, you know, I'm the self-limiter. I'm the one who has all these hang-ups. Nobody else does. And that's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing.
You're now about 10-ish years down the track from that first MRI and from your diagnosis. What would be your best advice for someone who is struck with a stop in your tracks diagnosis like the one that you got?
I think it's very hard, and I don't want to give advice to people, because I think something like MS is so incredibly different for everybody. They call it a snowflake disease, and that means that it's, you know, my presentation is different from somebody else's presentation. I think the thing that I would say is, you know, Philip's advice to me, you know, Philip Roth, when he said to me, it's here and it's now, and today is today. And if you can get through today, then that's great. And tomorrow might be different and you'll deal with that when it happens, but don't do what I did, which was try and project and then get so overwhelmed by everything in front of you. You have to deal with the things that you have to deal with. And the other advice I would say is exercise. Just do as much as you can, as keep moving. Exercise is good for your brain, it's good for your body. But love yourself. keep loving yourself. Don't hate yourself. It's not your fault. You know, I think I blamed myself, like I said before, and I think that there was a lot of, there was so much shame involved in what, how I felt about things. And don't ever feel that, because that's just not true.
Okay, so I'm not sure about loving myself, but I'm more than happy to love you. That was an exquisite chat. I'm really enlivened. I'm inspired by the way that you live with such authenticity. We live, Caro, in a world filled with artifice, and you are just a breath of fresh air. Thank you so much for joining me on Brave Journeys.
Tammy, thank you so much for having me. You've asked me some questions that have really had to make, I've had to think a lot, and it's a real challenge, and I'm so grateful to you for spending so much time thinking about the book and thinking about the stories in it. So thank you.
Take care, beautiful. We will speak to each other soon. Thank you.
We will. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. The brave journey of my next guest is equally compelling, and I'm sure you won't want to miss it. Please join me by subscribing to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. Oh, and if you love the show, please don't forget to rate it and leave a review. Brave Journeys was created, hosted, and executive produced by me, Tam Faraday. But I couldn't do this without my wonderful team, including my audio editor, Zoltan Fecho, and a very special thank you to George Weinberg. Ask me any questions or let's chat about the episode on Instagram at Tam Faraday. That's TamFaraday. I'm Tam Faraday, and I'll see you on tammyfaraday.com. That's Tammy with an I. See you next week. Today's episode of Brave Journeys was brought to you by Tidy, professional organisers helping bring calm to your everyday.